If you look at a box score after a hockey game and you see that one team lost 4-1, but they outshot their opponent 40-22, your brain instantly tells you a story.
Right, you think they dominated.
Exactly. You think, wow, the team with 40 shots dominated. They were, incredibly unlucky. They ran into a hot goalie. The puck just didn't bounce their way, but they were clearly the better team on the ice.
Which is completely logical.
Yeah, it makes sense. But according to the deepest analytics in the sport, your brain is actually lying to you. Like the shot clock is lying to
It absolutely is.
you. Because, in fact, that 40-22 shot discrepancy tells you almost nothing about who played better. So today, we are diving into the invisible macro layer of hockey strategy. We are talking about game management.
It's the perfect place to start. Because what you just described, that box score illusion, it's the fundamental trick of hockey. We are so conditioned to watch the physical action on the ice.
The skating, the hitting.
Right. The skating, the passing, the physics of a puck hitting a net. And because we focus on that, we miss the invisible algorithm running in the background. The score and the clock are constantly bending the laws of physics out there.
Which is wild to think about.
Yeah, and game management is really the art of understanding how those two variables, time and score, dictate every single decision a player makes.
Well, welcome to the deep dive, everyone. We are extracting the core principles from a massive comprehensive guide on game management today. And our mission today is mastery.
Definitely.
We aren't going to talk about the biomechanics of a wrist shot or, how to properly cross over when you skate backwards. We want to help you master the mental chess match of hockey so deeply that you can read the game like an elite coach.
Yeah, to see the matrix, basically.
Exactly. We want you to perfectly anticipate the shifting momentum of any match, whether you're trying to apply these principles in your own beer league games on a Tuesday night or you're just watching the playoffs from your couch.
And to achieve that level of mastery, we need to establish one critical distinction right out of the gate. Unless we are explicitly quoting a rule book law, and we will definitely be digging into the exact wording of the NHL, IIHF, and USA hockey rule books today, everything we discuss is a coaching choice.
Okay.
It's a calculated risk. A 2-1 lead with 4 minutes left in the third period is, functionally, an entirely different sport than a 2-1 lead in the first period.
Wait, an entirely different sport.
Essentially, yes. The rules of engagement change, the value of the puck changes, even the geometry of the ice changes.
Okay, let's unpack this because I want to go back to that 40-22 shot discrepancy. If the team with 40 shots didn't necessarily play better, what exactly is the shot clock telling us? Like, why is it deceiving us?
Well, it's telling us who is trailing in the game. This is known in hockey analytics as the score effect.
The score effect.
Right. It is the oldest, most mathematically established finding in the entire sport. And the concept is incredibly reliable. Basically, trailing teams shoot the puck more, and leading teams shoot the puck less.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense.
Yeah, and that behavioral effect grows exponentially as the deficit grows and as the clock ticks down towards zero.
So the scoreboard literally dictates human behavior. The team down 3-1 is panicking, so they throw absolutely everything at the net from every conceivable angle, while the team up 3-1 just, what, stops caring about generating offense.
Precisely. The trailing team becomes desperate and the leading team becomes conservative. But what's fascinating here is how profoundly this distorts our ability to evaluate raw statistics.
How so?
Well, for decades, hockey analysts used raw shot attempt numbers, a metric called Corsi, to evaluate if a player or a team was driving play.
I've heard of Corsi. It's basically just counting every time the puck is shot at the net, right?
Exactly. The logic was sound. If you are generating more shot attempts than you are giving up, you generally have the puck more, and you will eventually score more.
Right, because goals are rare and random, but shot attempts are frequent, so they give you a larger sample size to judge a team's actual possession and dominance.
Exactly. But the score effect completely corrupted that data. Analysts realized that counting every single shot attempt was deeply flawed if you didn't account for what the scoreboard said at the exact moment the shot was taken.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, if a team is up 4-0 in the third period, they're actively allowing the other team to take low-danger shots from the perimeter just to kill the clock.
So including those perimeter shots in the data makes the losing team look like an offensive juggernaut, when in reality, the leading team is just playing prevent defense.
Exactly. It's totally misleading.
So how did the analytics community solve that? Did they just stop counting shots and blowouts?
Initially, yeah, they really did. The evolution of the stats started with something called Corsi tied, which literally only counted shot attempts when the game was tied.
You're kidding!
No, I'm serious. Then they expanded it slightly to Corsi close, which counted shots when the game was tied or within one goal in the first two periods or tied in the third.
Wow, they were literally throwing away massive chunks of data from games because it was mathematically deceptive.
They had to. They found that a team shot differential in a tied game was actually a much better predictor of their future success in the standings than their current win-loss record.
That is wild. They just tossed out third period data if a team was up by two goals because the human behavioral shift was so extreme it broke the math.
Yeah, but today the modern approach is much more sophisticated. Analysts use score-adjusted numbers. Instead of throwing data away, they weight it.
Okay, so a shot attempt taken when you are down 3-0 in the third period is mathematically weighted far less in the algorithm than a shot taken in a tight 1-1 game in the first period.
You nailed it.
Yeah.
That's exactly how they fix the data.
Okay, I want to push back on this conservative behavior from the leading team for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
You're describing it almost like it's a flaw or like it ruins the data. But isn't retreating when you have a lead just smart? Like, it reminds me of defensive driving on the highway.
Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, like, if I'm ahead of schedule, I don't weave in and out of traffic at 90 miles an hour. I get in the middle lane, I play it safe, I give myself plenty of following distance, and I let the desperate guys make the risky lane changes.
Right.
Why wouldn't a hockey team do the exact same thing?
Well, it's a great analogy, and you're right, retreating is smart, but only to a very specific point. The logic of the retreat is based on the concept of asymmetric stakes.
Asymmetric stakes. Okay, what does that mean in hockey?
Let's look at the math of a game. If it's tied 1-1 and you score to go up 2-1, that goal is incredibly valuable. Yeah. It shifts your win probability massively.
Obviously. You take the lead.
But once you have that 2-1 lead, the stakes become asymmetrical. Conceding a goal to the opponent, which makes it 2-2, hurts your win probability far, far more than scoring a third goal to make it 3-1 helps you.
Okay, so the risk-reward ratio completely flips.
Exactly. A goal against costs you more than a goal for gains you. Furthermore, time becomes a tangible weapon on your side. If the clock runs out and literally nothing else happens on the ice, you win.
So you have absolutely no mathematical incentive to force the issue. The burden of action is entirely on the trailing team.
Exactly. And because the trailing team has to force the issue, they start cheating. They push their defenseman higher up into the offensive zone. They start taking risks on passes.
Trying to make something happen out of nothing.
Right. And by defending slightly deeper, the leading team can actually exploit those desperate mistakes. The trailing team overcommits, leaving themselves incredibly vulnerable to counterattacks going the other way.
But here is where my defensive driving analogy crashes into a wall, I think, because the source material explicitly warns about something called the trap of pure retreat.
Ah, yes. The pure retreat.
I see this in amateur hockey all the time. A team gets a one-goal lead with 5 minutes left, and suddenly they stop playing hockey. All five guys drop down below the hash marks. They form a human wall in front of their own goaltender, and they just, like, brace for impact.
And that is a complete catastrophe. It is the quickest way to lose a hockey game.
Why is it so bad, though? It feels safe.
It feels safe, but it's an illusion. Let's break down exactly why the pure passive retreat is so dangerous. When you are defending a lead, your prime directive is that you must trade the volume of shots against for the quality of shots against.
Meaning, I will gladly let you shoot 15 times from the blue line 50 feet away, but I will absolutely not let you shoot once from the edge of the crease 5 feet away.
Right, you give up the outside to protect the inside. But when you drop all five of your players into a passive box right in front of your goalie, a cascading series of failures begins. First, you never get the puck back.
Because you're just standing there.
Exactly. If you were just standing there blocking lanes, the other team just keeps recycling the puck to the perimeter. And if you never get the puck back, your players can't go to the bench to change lines.
Oh, man. So you are just trapping your own guys out there. It's a siege mentality, but you have no supply lines.
That's a perfect way to put it. Your legs die. Fatigue in your own zone is exactly how one goal leads die. Second, by collapsing everyone down to the net front, you think you are protecting your goalie, but you are actually blinding them.
Right, you're creating a massive screen.
Exactly. The goalie can't see the release of the puck. Furthermore, you are conceding the most dangerous area on the ice for rebounds, deflections, and chaotic scrambles. Those are the absolute highest danger chances in hockey.
And if my guys are out there for 2 straight minutes just blocking shots and gasping for air, they're going to get desperate, right?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. When your feet stop moving because you're exhausted, your stick starts reaching. You try to hook an opponent's waist, or you accidentally trip them because you're a step behind. Suddenly, the referee's arm goes up.
And handing a desperate trailing team a power play late in the game because you were too tired to defend properly, that is a monumental failure of game management.
It's the ultimate sin in that situation.
You know, the source points out an interesting myth here that I want to highlight. Sometimes you'll hear commentators or old school coaches say that trailing teams generate better shot quality from cycle attacks, like grinding it out in the corners while leading teams score off fast rush attacks.
Right. You hear that all the time on broadcasts.
But the guide explicitly warns us to treat that with suspicion. There's apparently no actual traced data or statistical study to back that up. It's just an untraced assertion masquerading as analytics.
Which is exactly why we have to be rigorous about how we study this game. We have to separate measured mathematical fact from coaching lore.
So what is the measured fact here?
The measured fact is this. Protecting a lead requires active management, not a passive shell. You have to pressure the puck carrier enough to force them into making a decision, even if you are prioritizing defensive posture.
So how do we actively protect a lead without just hiding in front of the net? To explain this, we need to map out the ice. The source provides this incredible mental model. It's a risk map based entirely on the cost of turning the puck over.
I love this model. It's so visual.
Yeah. I want you, the listener, to picture a hockey rink and imagine the ice painted in a gradient of red based on how heavily a mistake will punish you.
It is a brilliant framework. You grade every single square foot of ice by asking one simple question. If I am carrying the puck and I lose it right here, how many seconds and how many of my teammates stand between this turnover and an unbothered shot on my net?
Okay, let's paint the map. What is the darkest, deepest red, like the absolute highest risk area on the ice?
The darkest red is your own slot. That is the area directly in front of your own net, generally between the two face-off circles. A turnover here isn't just a scoring chance for the opponent. It is functionally an automatic goal against.
Why is it an automatic goal? I mean, the goalie is right there.
Because of the geometry and the readiness of your defense. If you have the puck in your own slot, your team is transitioning to offense. Your defenders are likely turning up the ice, looking to receive a pass.
Right. Everyone is looking the wrong way.
Exactly. Mm. Your goaltender might be relaxing slightly or looking up ice to see the play develop. If you turn the puck over right there, the opponent gets the puck in the most dangerous shooting location on the rink. Your goalie is completely unset, and your defenders are facing the wrong direction with 0 seconds to recover.
Wow. Okay, so you must never, ever lose the puck in your own slot.
Never.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. So we move outward from the slot to the rest of your defensive zone, the corners, the half wall. It's still red, but maybe a slightly lighter shade.
Yeah, a mistake here is bad, but you have 5 guys back, you're relatively organized, and you're maybe 30 to 40 feet from your net, so the goal has a split second to react.
But here's the part of the map that completely shocked me. The neutral zone. The band across the middle of the ice between the two blue lines. The guide shades center ice, the exact same danger level as your defensive zone. Why on earth is center ice just as dangerous as your own end?
Because of the direction of momentum. This is a crucial concept. In your own defensive zone, a turnover is dangerous because of proximity to the net. But your team is fundamentally structured defensively. Everyone is grouped together.
Okay, so you have numbers.
Right. But think about what happens when your team carries the puck into the neutral zone.
We're transitioning to offense. My forwards are blowing past the opponent's blue line. My defensemen are skating forward to join the rush.
Exactly. You are spreading out and accelerating. If you turn the puck over right at the red line, you likely have 2 or 3 of your own players skating forward at full speed, going the completely wrong way.
Oh, man. So they're completely out of the play.
Right. A turnover in the neutral zone instantly creates an odd man rush for the opponent, a 2-on-1 or a 3-on-2 counterattack. Your defensive structure is completely shattered, and the opponent has open ice to attack your remaining defenders with speed.
That is a phenomenal insight. So your own end is extremely dangerous but highly organized. Center ice is dangerous because it is completely disorganized.
Yes, that's exactly the difference.
And then finally, the absolute safest ice on the rink is the deep offensive zone, the opponent's corners. Let's shade that blue on our mental map.
Yes, the deep offensive zone is the cheapest ice on the sheet to make a mistake. If you try a crazy, through the legs pass deep in their corner and turn it over, you are 150 feet away from your own net, and you have all five of your teammates standing between the puck and your goalie.
So that is where you have permission to be highly creative.
Exactly, because the cost of failure is mostly just a long skate back to your zone.
So if I'm a player and we're up by a goal with 6 minutes left, what are the practical, hard and fast rules I derive from this map?
Rule number one, never, ever make a cross ice pass through the middle of your own defensive zone or through the neutral zone.
Because of the momentum shift.
Right. If a cross ice pass is intercepted in the neutral zone, the opponent is instantly going back the other way on an odd man rush. Rule number two, absolutely no blind D-to-D passes across your own goal mouth.
A D-to-D pass meaning one defenseman passing to his defensive partner.
Correct. When you are behind your own net and you blindly throw the puck across the front of your crease, hoping your partner is there, you are passing the puck directly through the darkest red zone on the map. If an opposing stick tips that pass, it's in the back of your net.
So what do you do instead? If I can't pass across the ice and I have a forechecker breathing down my neck, how do I get the puck out?
You manage the puck, not just the clock. You use the boards. You make a short, deliberate chip or flip of the puck off the glass, high past the forechecker, and out into the neutral zone.
But what if no one is there?
Doesn't matter. Yes, you might not complete a tape-to-tape pass. You might even lose possession of the puck entirely. But you are dictating where you lose possession. You lose it 100 feet from your net in a situation where all five of your teammates are facing the right way and ready to defend.
Okay, so let me just recap this module. If I'm listening to this on my way to my beer league game tonight, what you're really telling me is that protecting a lead isn't about playing coward's hockey, and it isn't about padding my pass completion stats.
Another goal.
It's about aggressively dictating the geography of the game. I want to trade high-danger slot shots for low-danger perimeter shots, and I want to make sure that if I make a mistake, I make it in the blue zone, not the dark red zone.
That is the perfect synthesis. You are actively forcing the opponent to navigate the hardest possible path to your net.
Awesome. Okay, so we've established this beautiful mathematical risk map. We know where to pass, where not to pass, and how to defend the slot. But hockey isn't played on a chalkboard.
No, definitely not.
It is played by human beings who are exhausting themselves anaerobically. When a player's lungs are burning 50 seconds into a shift, does that perfect risk map just go out the window?
It absolutely does, which is why the physical reality of the sport dictates the strategy. You can have the most brilliant tactical mind in the world, but if your players cannot physically execute the system, you will lose.
Which brings us to the anatomy of fatigue and shift discipline. What is a standard shift length in hockey? Because to a basketball player who plays 12 straight minutes or a soccer player who plays 45 minutes a half, hockey shift times sound completely absurd.
Yeah, they really do. A well-managed shift for a professional hockey player is generally between 35 and 45 seconds.
45 seconds, that's it.
That's it. Because hockey is not an aerobic sport. It is highly anaerobic. It requires repeated bursts of explosive maximal effort. You are sprinting on steel blades, wrestling with 200-pound men in the corners, and absorbing physical hits.
It's basically an all-out sprint the entire time.
Exactly. And here is the crucial game management layer. When you are actively protecting a lead late in a game, or when you are pinned deep in your own defensive zone, coaches actually demand that shift lengths drop even further, down to 30 or 35 seconds.
Wait, why do they shorten it when the stakes are highest? What exactly happens to the human body when a hockey player crosses that 45-second threshold?
It's a fascinating cascading failure, and it happens in a very specific sequential order. The first thing to fail when you get tired isn't your legs, it's your brain. Your decision-making speed drops precipitously.
It's like your brain loses its broadband connection. You're lagging. Your eyes see the play developing. You recognize the passing lane, but the signal takes an extra half second to process.
That's exactly it. You suffer cognitive lag. You process the geometry of the game slower. You see fewer passing options. And the ones you do see, you recognize too late to execute. Your spatial awareness shrinks.
And then what? After the brain lags, what's the second failure point?
The second failure point is the feet.
Ah, the lactic acid kicks in.
Right. The oxygen debt becomes too high. You stop taking those deep, powerful strides, and you start gliding. You stand upright. And when your feet stop moving, you start trying to make up the distance you are losing by reaching with your stick.
Which leads to penalties.
Exactly. This is where those hooking, holding, and tripping penalties come from. They aren't signs of aggressive defense. They're the desperate symptoms of lazy, exhausted feet.
Okay, so brain fails, then feet fail. What's next?
Third is support. You arrive a second too late to help your teammate win a battle for a loose puck along the wall. The opponent wins a two-on-one battle because you couldn't get there in time.
And finally?
Finally, the fourth and most devastating failure is the back check.
The willingness to sprint 100 feet back to your own end to stop an odd man rush.
Yes. The back check requires pure, agonizing effort. It is the last thing to fail, and it is the most expensive failure in the sport because it directly and consistently leads to goals against.
So staying out there too long is basically sabotage.
Taking a 90-second shift isn't just a matter of being tired. You are actively costing your team goals. You are destroying your team's defensive structure, and you are ruining your own physical ability to recover for your next shift.
Which brings us to a concept the source material calls one of the most expensive routine mistakes in all of hockey. The bad change. Changing lines at the wrong time.
The bad change is so punishing because it is actually three catastrophic mistakes happening simultaneously.
Let's break those down. Think about the mechanics of changing lines. A player skates off the ice to the bench, and a new player jumps over the boards to replace them. When you do this at the wrong time, what's the first mistake?
First, you are instantly conceding a numbers disadvantage on the ice.
Mm.
For those 2 or 3 seconds it takes to swap players, you are essentially playing shorthanded. You are skating away from the play.
And
second, you concede a structural hole. Every player on the ice has a specific job. Maybe you are the center, and your job is to cover the high slot. When you abandon that job to go change, that high danger area is completely unguarded until your replacement gets there.
And third?
Third, the fresh teammate jumping over the boards is entering the play completely blind. They haven't been tracking the puck. They don't know the momentum of the opposing players. They are jumping into chaos.
So what are the golden rules for line changes to avoid this triple disaster?
Rule one, never, under any circumstances, change lines when the puck is in your defensive zone and your team does not have clear, uncontested control of it.
So if there's a battle on the wall, stay out there.
Exactly. If there is a battle for a loose puck in your corner and you skate to the bench, you just gave the opponent a 5-on-4 power play in the darkest red zone of the risk map. Rule two, never change when you are the last man back defending a rush. And rule three, communication is non-negotiable. You must yell, "I'm changing," or "last man," to your teammates so they can adjust the structure to cover for you.
Okay, let's look at the ultimate nightmare scenario. What if I'm trapped? I'm a defenseman. I've been stuck on the ice in my own zone for 65 seconds. My lungs are on fire. My legs feel like concrete. My brain is lagging.
You're in trouble.
I finally get the puck on my stick. The only thing I want in the world is to go to the bench and sit down. My instinct is just to put my head down and blast the puck as hard as I can all the way down the other end of the ice so the referee blows the whistle and I can get off.
And if you do that, you have just triggered the icing trap. It is a self-inflicted wound that coaches absolutely despise.
Let's define the rule first, because I want to understand exactly why this is a trap. What is icing?
Icing occurs when a player shoots the puck from their half of the center red line all the way past the opponent's goal line without the puck being touched by any other player and without going into the net.
And historically, players did exactly what I just described, right? They got tired, they iced the puck, the whistle blew, and they got to go to the bench for a rest while the next line came out for the faceoff.
Exactly. But the rulebook recognized that was a loophole that rewarded teams for being tired and playing boring hockey.
So they changed the rule to brutally punish that exact behavior?
Yes, they did. Under NHL Rule 81 and the IIHF equivalent, if your team commits an icing infraction, you are strictly barred from substituting any players before the ensuing faceoff.
So wait, I shoot the puck down the ice, my lungs are burning, I skate to the bench, and the referee points at me and says, "No, get back out there."
It is absolute dread. Not only do you have to stay on the ice, but the faceoff comes all the way back into your defensive zone.
Oh, my God.
So you are now handing the opponent a faceoff 20 feet from your net in your darkest red zone, and you have to defend it with your five most utterly exhausted players.
Can I just call a timeout? Like, in basketball, if my guys are gassed, I call a quick 30-second timeout to let them catch their breath.
Under NHL and IIHF rules, absolutely not. Rule 87.1 explicitly states that no timeout shall be granted to the defensive team following an icing. You are completely trapped. You cannot change, you cannot rest, and you have to defend a set play in your own zone.
That is the sunk cost fallacy perfectly realized on ice. The player thinks, I'm so tired, I just need a whistle. But the cost of that whistle is mathematically worse than just eating a body check and softly chipping the puck into the neutral zone, even if the other team gets it right back.
Right, because at least if you chip it to the neutral zone, it's not icing, and you can scramble to the bench.
That is exactly the calculation a player must make. Are there any exceptions to this no-change rule on icing? What if I'm literally bleeding or I break a bone?
There are a few incredibly narrow carve-outs. You can change to replace a goaltender who had been pulled for an extra attacker. You can, of course, replace a genuinely injured player, though referees are highly suspicious of players suddenly faking cramps after an icing.
Naturally.
And you can change if a penalty has been assessed that alters the on-ice numerical strength of either team.
What about equipment failure? I've seen guys break a skate blade and literally have to crawl back to the bench because they can't stand up.
This is one of the most fascinating quirks we found in the rule books. It highlights how carefully players and coaches have to read the text. Under the IIHF rules, which govern international tournaments like the Olympics, as well as leagues in Europe, Rule 81.4 specifically lists a player with a broken skate as a valid exception to the icing no change rule.
Oh, good. That seems humane. So if I'm in Europe and my skate breaks, I can get off the ice.
Not so fast. The IIHF rulebook actually contradicts itself. If you flip one page over to Rule 82.1, which also covers substitutions during icing, it does not list the broken skate exception. It only lists the same three standard exceptions as the NHL.
You're kidding. So the rulebook says yes on one page and no on the next. What happens if you actually try to change a guy with a broken skate?
It becomes a massive, dangerous gamble. If the officials on the ice decide to strictly follow Rule 82.1 and refuse the change, they will send your substitute player back to the bench and issue a formal warning to your team.
And let me guess, a warning is bad.
Very bad. Because here is the kicker. If your bench has already received a warning earlier in the game for any reason, attempting that illegal change results in a 2-minute bench minor penalty for delay of game.
So you could turn an icing situation with exhausted players into a penalty kill with exhausted players, all because the rulebook has a typo. That is wild.
It proves that game management isn't just about on-ice geometry. It's about intimate knowledge of the legislative framework you're operating within. And to further complicate things, these rules are not universal.
Wait, really? USA Hockey is different.
Yes. USA Hockey, which governs almost all amateur, high school, and adult recreational play in the United States, does not enforce the no change on icing rule. You can ice it and change freely.
And Hockey Canada?
Hockey Canada only enforces the no change rule at specific high-level categories, like U18 AAA and Major Junior. But even where Hockey Canada does enforce it, they still allow the defending coach to use their timeout to rest the players, unlike the NHL.
So you really have to know the specific rule book of the league you are playing in because it completely dictates your macro strategy.
Absolutely.
So to synthesize all of this for my own understanding, shift length is actually a defensive metric. If I'm staying out there past 45 seconds, I am actively degrading my brain's ability to process the game. I'm guaranteeing a penalty because my feet will stop moving. And if I panic and ice the puck in an NHL game, I am springing a trap on my own team that we cannot escape from.
That is an excellent summary of the physical reality of the sport. What do we want to remember here? Keep your shifts short to keep your brain sharp.
Perfect. All right, let's flip the ice. We spent a lot of time talking about how a leading team retreats, manages risk, and avoids traps. But what if you are the team that's losing?
Right, the other side of the coin.
If the leading team is sitting back in this highly structured, low-risk shell, how do trailing teams break through without recklessly destroying their own defensive structure and giving up a counterattack?
It all comes down to scaling your risk against the time remaining on the clock. The source material outlines a very clear ladder of escalation for trailing teams. Let's say you are down by one goal in the first period.
Lots of time left.
Exactly. You change absolutely nothing. You play your normal system. Taking massive structural risks in the first period to tie the game is foolish, because conceding a second goal that early severely damages your long-term win probability.
Makes sense.
But let's fast forward. Let's say you are down by two goals in the middle of the third period. The math changes completely.
Why? A two-goal deficit is worse.
It is worse, but time is running out. At this point, treating a goal for a goal is no longer a mathematical loss for you. If you give up a goal on a counterattack, yes, you're down by three, which is bad. But you have to score two goals to survive.
So we have to.
You need to start activating your defensemen deep into the offensive play, even if it means accepting a much higher risk of an odd man rush the other way. And if you are down three goals in the third period, the math says you must be extremely aggressive early in the period rather than waiting until the final 5 minutes to press the issue.
Let's get into the mechanics of that aggression. When you say activating defensemen, one of the most common tactical terms you hear is the pinch. What exactly is a pinch, and how does a coach distinguish a good pinch from a bad pinch?
Well, a pinch happens when a defenseman is stationed at the offensive blue line. The opponent gets the puck and starts moving up the sideboards trying to break out of their zone.
Right, and normally the defenseman's job is to slowly back up into the neutral zone, keeping the play in front of them to play safe defense, right?
Right, but when a defenseman pinches, they do the opposite. They aggressively step forward. They step down the boards into the attacking zone to try and intercept the puck or check the opponent before they can cross the blue line.
It's a massive gamble. You are essentially jumping a passing lane in football. If you intercept it, great, you keep the offense alive. But if you miss that interception, the receiver is behind you with open field.
Precisely. If the defenseman pinches and misses, the opponent is past them, and you have instantly created a highly dangerous odd man rush going the other way.
Huh.
This is why coaches are so wary of it.
So what structural safety net has to exist for a coach to greenlight that gamble? What makes a pinch good?
A good pinch has almost nothing to do with the defenseman who is actually pinching. It is entirely dependent on the structure behind them.
Oh, interesting.
In hockey, the three forwards are usually labeled F1, F2, and F3 based on how deep they are in the offensive zone. If a defenseman decides to pinch down the right wall, another player, usually the center, acting as F3, must recognize it instantly and rotate high up into the zone near the blue line to cover the exact spatial void the defenseman just abandoned.
Got it. And the other defenseman?
The other defenseman must slide over to hold the middle of the ice.
Okay, I love this framing. A good pinch isn't defined by whether the defenseman successfully wins the puck. It's defined by what happens if they completely fail.
That is the exact mental model. If the defenseman pinches and completely whiffs on the puck, but your F3 forward is rotating high and your partner is holding the middle, the worst outcome for your team is that the opponent gets a 2-on-2 rush up the ice. You have numerical equality. You can safely defend a 2-on-2.
And a bad pinch.
A bad pinch happens when the F3 forward is caught deep in the corner battling for the puck or below the opponent's goal line. If the defenseman decides to pinch then, and they miss the puck, there is absolutely no one rotating to cover their space. It instantly becomes a clean 2-on-1 rush for the opponent.
So the decision to pinch was mathematically incorrect before the defenseman even took their first stride, regardless of whether they won the puck or not, because the failure state was catastrophic.
Exactly. The math was bad from the start.
That's the micro level of calculated risk. But let's zoom out to the ultimate macro level risk in hockey. Pulling the goaltender. This is where the modern analytics revolution has completely upended a century of traditional hockey thinking, hasn't it?
It has fundamentally rewritten the final minutes of the sport. For decades, traditional coaching lore dictated that you only pulled your goaltender for an extra attacking skater in the final 60 to 90 seconds of a game. It was a desperation heave.
But every single serious analytical study over the last 50 years has reached the exact same undeniable conclusion, right? Coaches pull the goalie far, far too late.
Far too late.
I need you to give me the math on this, because pulling your goalie and staring at an empty net is terrifying. Walk me through the numbers.
Let's look at the foundational data from the 2007-2008 NHL season, which really sparked this revolution. When a team pulled their goalie and played six skaters against five, they generated a goal on average every 8.5 minutes of ice time.
That is essentially power play efficiency.
Yes. To put that in perspective, when teams were playing normal 5-on-5 hockey, it took an average of about 27 minutes of ice time to score a goal.
Okay, so mathematically, adding that sixth skater is a massive, overwhelming offensive lever. You more than triple your scoring rate?
You do.
But the obvious counterargument is staring right at us.
Huh.
You have no goalie. The other team can just lob the puck from 200 feet away and score.
And they do. The empty net is incredibly dangerous. The data shows that opponents score on the empty net at a rate of roughly 19 goals per 60 minutes of play. It is a genuine, heavily weighted cost.
Okay, so it's a huge risk.
It is. But here is where the asymmetric stakes come back in. You are trailing. You are already losing the game. Conceding an empty net goal and losing by two goals instead of one means absolutely nothing in the standings. A loss is a loss.
But scoring the tying goal guarantees you at least 1 point in the standings if you make it to overtime.
Exactly. So you run the simulation, you weigh the 8.5-minute scoring rate against the 19 goals against rate, factoring in the time remaining.
What is the optimal time to pull then?
Researchers ran a simulation of over 150 million hockey games using these variables. The math dictates that when you are down by one goal, the optimal strategy to maximize your chances of earning a point is to pull the goaltender around the 3-minute mark of the third period.
3 full minutes left. Wait, hold on. If I'm an NHL head coach and I pull my goalie with 3 full minutes left in a one-goal game and the opponent immediately intercepts the puck and scores on the empty net, the fans will boo me out of the building. The media will crucify me. I might get fired.
And you have just identified the exact friction point between analytics and human nature. Traditional coaching behavior is often driven by job security and loss aversion.
Meaning they'd rather fail conventionally.
Yes. Coaches would rather lose a game normally by leaving the goalie in and running out of time than risk looking foolish by pulling the goalie early and getting blown out. But the math doesn't care about the coach's feelings.
Right. Over an 82-game season, adopting the aggressive 3-minute goalie pull strategy is worth what? An estimated 1.5 extra points in the standings.
Yes. And in the NHL, 1 point is routinely the difference between making the playoffs and going home.
Let me throw a crazy scenario at you. What if I am trailing by a goal late in the game, say there's 4 minutes left, and the opposing team takes a penalty? So I'm going on a standard 5-on-4 power play. Do I pull the goalie then to make it a 6-on-4 advantage?
Yes, you absolutely do. In fact, the analytics strongly suggest that trailing teams should pull the goalie much earlier during a power play than they would at 5-on-5.
Really? Why?
A 6-on-4 advantage is an overwhelmingly powerful offensive state. Because you have two extra skaters, you can stretch the defensive penalty kill box to the breaking point. You are almost as likely to score on a 6-on-4 as you are to concede an empty net goal. And because you are trailing, you need that goal.
Okay, the math is settled. But pulling the goalie with 3 or 4 minutes left creates a massive logistical problem. 3 minutes means multiple line changes. I can't just put my 5 best star players on the ice and leave them there for 3 minutes. They will physically collapse.
No, they would pass out.
So my second and third line players have to know how to play 6-on-5. How does a team properly execute a 6-on-5 attack?
Structure is vital because if you treat it like a chaotic scramble, the defending team will just wait for a mistake and clear the puck. First, you do not use the sixth man as just another perimeter passer.
So where does he go?
The absolute highest value of the extra attacker is creating traffic. You put that sixth player directly in front of the opposing goaltender to create a massive screen and hunt for garbage rebounds.
Okay, that makes sense.
Second, you must move the puck with rapid one-touch passes. The defending team is down a man. They can only cover so much ground. The puck can always move faster than a human can skate. You have to pass it faster than their defensive box can slide side to side.
And what about the two defensemen operating at the blue line? What is their role?
The absolute cardinal rule of 6-on-5 offense is that the 2-point men must never, ever pinch at the same time. Remember our discussion about the bad pinch?
Right.
Now imagine making a bad pinch when there is no goalie behind you. If a puck squirts loose along the wall and both defensemen dive down to try and keep it in the zone and the puck gets past them, it is a 100% guaranteed goal for the opponent.
So one defenseman must always, always be prepared to retreat into the neutral zone and act as a safety valve.
Exactly. What if I'm on the other side? I am the team with the lead defending against the 6-on-5. 6 guys are swarming my zone. What's the strategy?
Yeah, how do you defend that?
The most important rule for the defending team is do not chase the puck. If you break your defensive structure and start chasing the puck carrier into the corners, the 6 attackers will brilliantly pick you apart because they always have an open man.
So you just stand there?
You hold your ground. You form a very tight, compact box or diamond shape right in the middle of your slot, protecting that dark red zone we talked about. Keep your sticks active in the passing lanes and force them to keep the puck on the perimeter. Let them pass it around the boards all day.
And when my defending team finally intercepts a pass, I just want to heave the puck as far down the ice as humanly possible, right? Just clear it in panic.
No, and this is a crucial game-losing mistake that players make under pressure. When you are defending a 6-on-5, every time you attempt to clear the puck, you are essentially taking a shot on goal. You must get your head up and aim for the empty net.
But why can't I just blast it off the glass?
If you just blindly heave it off the glass in panic, and it goes straight to their defenseman at the blue line, you have bought your exhausted team absolutely zero relief. They just reset the attack.
But wait, let's play this out. I get the puck, I look up, I aim for the empty net 200 feet away, I shoot, and I miss by 2 inches. The puck slides all the way down the ice past the goal line. Isn't that icing?
Yes. And this is a terrifying scenario that ties all our lessons together.
Okay, tell me why.
Under NHL Rule 81.3, an icing infraction is not nullified just because the opposing team's goalie is pulled. Think about the math. You have 5 skaters, they have 6 skaters. But the rule book considers a pulled goalie a tactical substitution. 6 skaters against 5 skaters plus an empty net is considered equal numerical strength for the purposes of icing.
Oh my God. So if I try to score on the empty net and miss, the whistle blows, the faceoff comes all the way back to my defensive zone. And because of the icing rule we discussed in Module 2, my 5 exhausted defenders cannot change lines.
Exactly.
Sure.
You are trapped in your own end facing 6 attackers with dead legs, a scrambling structure, and you cannot call a timeout. It is the ultimate devastating punishment for missing an empty net shot.
That is incredibly high stakes. Every decision is fraught. Let's touch on one more goalie pull scenario before we move on, because this one is actually risk-free. It's the delayed penalty freebie.
This is one of the most underutilized advantages in amateur and lower-level hockey, but you see it executed perfectly in the NHL.
Explain how it works.
Under NHL Rule 15.1, if the opponent commits a penalty, say they trip one of your players, but they do not have possession of the puck, the referee simply raises an arm straight up in the air to signal a delayed penalty. Play continues seamlessly until the offending team touches the puck.
So the whistle will not blow until the bad guys gain possession.
Correct. Which means, practically speaking, the offending team cannot score. The moment that referee's arm goes up, your goaltender should instantly drop their stick and sprint to the bench for an extra attacker.
So you get to play 6-on-5 hockey with zero risk of the opponent shooting the puck into your empty net, because the split second they touch the puck, the play is blown dead.
Exactly.
Zero risk? Right. Are you absolutely sure? Because this is hockey and disaster always finds a way.
Well, you are right to be skeptical. There is one hilariously tragic exception found deep in NHL Rule 78.5.
Let's hear it.
The only way the opponent can score during a delayed penalty is if you accidentally shoot the puck into your own empty net.
So going all the way back to our risk map from the beginning, this is exactly why the rule is never make a blind D-to-D pass across your own crease.
We know.
If you miss that pass to your partner during a delayed penalty, there is no goalie there to stop it. It just slides right into your own net and the goal counts.
Precisely. We see it happen in the NHL maybe once every 3 years, and it is always the highlight of the week on the blooper reels.
That is amazing.
That is why the tactical instruction during a delayed penalty is very specific. Keep the puck away from the opponent, maintain possession on the perimeter, do not force low percentage shots that the opposing goalie can easily catch and freeze to stop the play, and never ever pass the puck backward toward your own empty net.
So, synthesizing this section for our mental model, trailing teams have to scale their structural risk based on the ticking clock. A good pinch isn't about winning the puck, it's about having the F3 forward high to cover the failure state. The math definitively demands that we pull the goalie much earlier than our fear of looking stupid allows around the 3-minute mark for a 1-goal deficit. And during a delayed penalty, the goalie must sprint to the bench instantly because the opponent cannot legally score. What should the listener remember here?
That you are recalculating risk dynamically. Every second that ticks off the clock changes what is mathematically correct to do on the ice.
Awesome summary. We've talked extensively about manipulating time, score, and the geography of the ice, but hockey is played by players with different skill sets. Some guys are snipers, some guys are bruising defenders.
Yeah, the human element.
Let's talk about how coaches manipulate the actual humans on the ice. Let's talk about the chess match, line matching, and defense pairs.
The primary mechanism for the human chess match is a specific rulebook mechanic known as the last change.
Okay, what is the last change?
This rule is the absolute mechanical foundation of home ice advantage in hockey. Under NHL Rule 82.1, at any stoppage of play, a whistle, a goal, and offsides, the visiting team must put their lineup on the ice first.
Like they have to commit.
Yes. The referee physically points to the visiting bench and gives them 5 seconds to deploy their players. Once they are set, the referee points to the home bench, giving the home team 8 seconds to put their lineup on the ice.
So the home team gets to look at exactly who the visitors are playing and then perfectly tailor their response.
Exactly. They get the last move. The classic time-honored scenario is the home coach waiting on the bench, watching the visiting team put their top superstar scoring line on the ice. The moment those stars are locked in, the home coach deploys their rugged checking line.
Define a checking line for someone who might just casually watch the playoffs.
A checking line is a specific group of three forwards selected almost entirely for their defensive reliability, their prowess at winning faceoffs, and their physical grinding style of play, rather than their ability to score highlight reel goals.
So their entire purpose is to shadow the opponent's best players and suffocate them.
So if I'm the superstar on the visiting team and I know this checking line is just waiting to jump over the boards and smother me all night, what is my defense? How do I get away from them?
If you are on the road, your only defense is to avoid stoppages. You have to change on the fly during live open play.
Because the last change rule doesn't apply then.
Right. It only applies when the whistle blows. If your superstar line jumps over the boards while the puck is moving around the neutral zone, the home coach cannot immediately react with a clean, organized substitution of their checking line without risking a massive structural breakdown.
That requires incredible communication and shift discipline from the visiting team. But let's look at it from the other side. If I'm a grinder on that home checking line and I am sent out to defend the league's best player, what is my metric for success? I'm probably not going to score on them.
No, your metric for a perfect shift is 0-0 with zero penalties taken. If you are matched against superstars, your job is not to score. Your job is a zero-sum game. Make sure they do not score.
You just want to neutralize them.
Exactly. You grind them down physically along the boards. You keep the puck pinned deep in their defensive zone to make them exhaust themselves defending, and then you change lines safely. If the stars go back to the bench tired and frustrated with 0 points, the checking line won the shift.
Now let's talk about how coaches construct their defense pairings to handle these matchups, because this section of the source material completely blew my mind.
Oh, this is fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I always assumed coaches just put their best defensive player with their second best defensive player and called it a day. But it's not just about talent. It's heavily dictated by geometry and handedness.
The geometry of the ice dictates everything a defenseman can and cannot do. Every player in hockey shoots left-handed or right-handed. A left shot holds the stick with their left hand lower down on the shaft, meaning the blade of the stick rests on the left side of their body.
And playing on hand means what?
Playing on hand means a left shot defenseman plays on the left side of the ice and a right shot defenseman plays on the right side.
Why does that matter so much for a defenseman?
Let's visualize a very common scenario. Hold an imaginary stick in your hands. You are a left shot defenseman playing on the left side of the ice. The puck is dumped deep into your left corner. You skate back to retrieve it.
Okay, I'm with you.
Because your stick blade is naturally on the left side of your body, closest to the boards, you can pick up the puck and smoothly turn away from the attacking forechecker.
Yeah.
You use your back and your hips to shield the puck from them.
Oh, wow. So it's a physical advantage.
Huge advantage. And when you look up the ice to make a breakout pass to your winger on the boards, you are making that pass on your strong forehand side. It is incredibly safe and structurally sound.
Okay, now let's flip it. Let's say the coach puts a right-handed player over on that left side. They are playing offhand. What happens to the geometry?
Everything is backward. Yeah. To pick up that same puck off the left wall, the right-handed player's stick is on the inside of the ice. They have to turn their body into the boards to corral it, or they have to turn directly into the pressure of the forechecker.
So they can't shield the puck?
No, they cannot shield it effectively. And when they try to pass it up the left wall to the winger, they have to use their weaker, less accurate backhand. It invites turnovers in the dark red zone.
So coaches overwhelmingly prefer to pair one left-shot defenseman with one right-shot defenseman to maximize defensive safety and breakout efficiency.
Almost universally, yes.
But here is the aha moment from the guide. When a team goes on the power play and they need to score, coaches intentionally flip this logic. They put defensemen on their offhand side at the offensive blue line. Why abandon the safety?
Because it reverses the geometry in the offensive zone to maximize shooting leverage. If a left shot player is standing at the left point just inside the blue line, their stick blade is near the sideboards. But if you put a right shot player at that exact same left point spot, their stick blade is positioned directly in the middle of the ice.
Which sets up the devastating one-timer.
Exactly.
The puck is passed across the zone, and because the player is offhand, their stick is already cocked, loaded, and facing the net in the center of the ice. They don't have to stop the puck, shift it across their body, and then shoot. They just blast it instantly.
Exactly. The offhand position sacrifices defensive retrieval safety, which you don't need as much on a power play anyway, in exchange for massive, immediate offensive shooting power in the center of the ice. It is a brilliant manipulation of geometry.
That is so cool to visualize.
Before
we leave the chess match, I want to touch briefly on a statistic called zone starts. The source brings this up as a massive statistical illusion that fans and even amateur analysts constantly misinterpret.
Yes. Zone starts track the geographical location where a player begins their shifts, either in the offensive zone, the neutral zone, or the defensive zone.
Okay. Pretty straightforward.
Right. But if a coach trusts a checking line center, they will constantly deploy them for defensive zone faceoffs. That player might have 70% defensive zone starts, naturally, because they are constantly starting 200 feet away from the opponent's net under heavy pressure. Their offensive statistics, their goals and assists, are going to look significantly worse than a player who is constantly deployed in the offensive zone.
But the illusion isn't just the usage. It's in how these stats are calculated by different websites, right?
Correct. There is no standardized formula across the internet for zone starts. Some analytics websites calculate the percentage by taking offensive zone faceoffs and dividing them by all shift starts,
yep,
including shifts where the player jumped over the boards on the fly during live play.
And other websites.
Other websites only look at faceoffs, completely ignoring on-the-fly changes. So a player might be listed at 60% offensive zone starts on one popular site and a drastically different number on another site. If you do not read the glossary of the specific site you are using, you will completely misjudge a player's actual usage and value.
Synthesizing the chess match. Home ice advantage is mechanically driven by the last change rule, giving the home coach the final say on matchups. Road teams counter by executing changes on the fly.
Right.
Defensemen play on hand to safely shield the puck in the defensive zone, but deliberately switch to off hand on the power play to open up instantaneous one-timer shots from the middle of the ice. And always verify the math behind a website's zone start calculation.
Exactly. You are controlling the variables you can control.
Which brings us to the final frontier. We have survived 60 minutes of regulation. The game is tied. We are heading into NHL regular season 3-on-3 overtime. What happens when time runs out and the traditional 5-on-5 system breaks down into pure chaos?
It requires a complete tactical paradigm shift from the players. When 3-on-3 overtime was first introduced to the NHL, teams didn't know how to play it. It was chaotic, thrilling, end-to-end rushes. It looked like a basketball fast break.
I remember that. It was so exciting.
It was. But players and coaches quickly adapted and realized that 3-on-3 is not a shooting gallery. It is entirely a game of puck possession.
The source is absolutely adamant about this rule. If you do not have a high-quality look at the net, do not shoot the puck. Which sounds insane to a casual fan. Why wouldn't you shoot?
Because a missed shot in 3-on-3 is mathematically catastrophic. Think about the physics of a missed shot. You fire the puck, it misses the net, and it rings hard around the end boards.
And then what?
In 3-on-3, there is so much open ice that the boards essentially act as a perfect pass to the opposing team. The opponent picks up the rebound, and instantly, because your shooter's momentum carried them deep into the zone, the opponent has a 3-on-2 counterattack going the other way.
So a low percentage shot is literally just a turnover that launches a fast break. So what is the correct tactic if I cross the blue line and don't have a clean shot?
The controlled regroup. If you enter the offensive zone and the three defenders are in good position, blocking your path to the net, you literally turn around.
You skate away from the net.
Yes. You skate away from the net, carry the puck all the way back out into the neutral zone, or even pass it all the way back to your own goaltender, and you reset the attack. You retreat entirely to maintain possession. A team might hold the puck for 45 straight seconds without taking a single shot, just weaving around the ice.
Which drives the fans in the arena absolutely crazy. They are screaming, "Shoot the puck!" But mathematically, the players are doing exactly the right thing. So how do you actually score the winning goal if everyone is just playing keep away?
The winning goal in 3-on-3 usually does not come from an incredible highlight reel snipe into the top corner. It comes from exploiting human fatigue. You hold the puck, you weave, you make the three defenders chase you.
And wait for them to get tired.
You wait until one of those defenders is completely exhausted. Because in 3-on-3, you can never safely change lines unless your team has possession of the puck. so that tired defender gets isolated. Their feet stop moving. And the moment they stop gliding, you attack the massive spatial hole they leave behind. The kill shot is fatigue.
There is a really interesting nuance here for international play that the guide points out. The IIHF rules, which govern the Olympics and European leagues, also play 3-on-3 overtime, but they do not switch ends of the ice at the start of the period like the NHL does. Why does switching ends matter?
It is a critical geographical detail. In the NHL, switching ends for overtime means the defending team has what is called a long change. The bench is physically further away from their defensive zone.
Oh, I see.
So if a defender is trapped on the ice and exhausted, they have to skate a much longer distance to get off the ice, making it incredibly hard to change safely. Under IIHF rules, because they don't switch, the bench remains close to the defensive zone. That NHL tactic of isolating and trapping an exhausted defender is much less reliable in Europe.
Fascinating how a simple Zamboni door location changes international strategy. Now, let's talk about momentum. Is momentum actually a real measurable force in hockey? The source says it's genuinely disputed among analysts.
It is hotly disputed whether momentum exists as a quantifiable metric. But what is undeniable, mathematically and observationally, is that human beings behave differently immediately after a goal is scored.
How so?
The team that just conceded a goal is often in a highly vulnerable psychological state. They are either deflated and sluggish, or they become recklessly overeager, abandoning their structure to try and get the goal back immediately.
So coaches treat the 60 seconds immediately following a goal against as the most dangerous stretch in the sport. How do you counter that vulnerability?
With a tactic coaches call the simple shift. It is a deliberate, highly scripted, low-ambition shift. The coach will send out their most reliable, veteran players.
So no fancy plays, no offhand one-timers.
Absolutely none. No cross-ice passes, no defenseman pinching at the blue line. You take the puck, you dump it deep into the opponent's zone, you skate hard to hit them along the boards, and then you change lines safely.
So the goal isn't to score.
The entire goal of the simple shift is not to score. It is to stop the bleeding, stabilize the emotional temperature of the game, eat 35 seconds off the clock, and hand the game back to the bench in one structurally sound piece.
That brings us to our final topic of the deep dive, discipline as a function of game management, penalties. Obviously, everyone knows taking a penalty is bad, but the source frames this entirely mathematically. When is it actually worth taking a penalty on purpose?
You take a penalty intentionally when the action you are preventing has a statistically higher likelihood of becoming a goal than the power play you are giving up to the opponent.
Give me a concrete example.
Stopping an odd man rush late in a close game. Let's say it's a tie game, 3 minutes left, and you turn the puck over. The opponent is rushing down the ice on a clean 2-on-1. The pass goes across. The forward is about to tap it into an empty side of the net.
What do you do?
If you can reach out with your stick, hook his hands, and prevent the shot, you take the 2-minute minor penalty every single time. It is a smart mathematical trade. A cross-ice pass on a 2-on-1 is a massive high-danger chance. A standard power play only converts about 20% of the time. You traded a highly probable goal for a 20% chance of a goal.
But wait, the source gives a massive blinking red warning here about breakaways. It says you should never intentionally foul a player from behind on a clear breakaway. Why? What's the difference between a 2-on-1 and a breakaway?
The difference is the rulebook punishment. Under the rules, if a player is on a clear breakaway and you foul them from behind, it does not result in a standard 2-minute minor power play. The referee will point to center ice and award the opponent a penalty shot.
Just one shooter against your goalie.
Yes. And mathematically, across the league, a penalty shot has a significantly higher conversion rate than a 2-minute power play. By hooking him from behind, you took a bad situation and voluntarily traded it for a mathematically worse situation.
There's another penalty nightmare scenario here, specifically when your goalie is pulled for an extra backer.
This is a vital quirk of the rule book. Let's say you pulled your goalie. Your net is empty. The puck squirts loose into your crease, right on the goal line. An opposing player is skating hard to tap it in. Your instinct as a desperate defenseman is to dive into the crease and cover the loose puck with your hand to save the game.
Normally, if a goalie's in the net and a defenseman illegally covers the puck in the crease with his hand, the ref awards a penalty shot, right?
Yes, normally. But if your goalie is pulled and your net is empty, covering a loose puck in the crease does not result in a penalty, and it does not result in a penalty shot.
What happens then?
Under NHL, IIHF, and Hockey Canada rules, the referee will simply blow the whistle, point at the net, and automatically award a goal to the opposing team.
Boom. Game over. You literally award them a goal. So what are you supposed to do if the puck is loose in the empty crease?
You must bat it away. You can knock it straight down to the ice with your open hand or your stick and then sweep it away. But you absolutely cannot close your hand on it and you cannot pull it under your body.
Let's finish with frustration penalties. Retaliation after the whistle.
This is pure, unforced mathematical loss.
Yeah.
Let's say an opponent hits you late after the whistle. The referee sees it and raises their arm to call a penalty on them. Your team has just earned a strategic advantage. You are going on the power play.
Right.
If you lose your temper, turn around and slash that player in retaliation, the referee raises their other arm. You get a penalty too. The penalties cancel each other out. You took a hard-earned strategic advantage, and you voluntarily gave it back to the opponent because you couldn't control your emotions for 3 seconds.
And the source points out that these frustration penalties, the hooking and the tripping we talked about earlier, often happen because a player's feet stop moving. They get tired, they start gliding, they get beat by a faster player, and instead of taking the extra strides to catch up, they just lazily reach out with their stick to hook the guy's waist.
Yes. Poor discipline is very often just a physical conditioning problem in disguise. When the legs die, the stick commits the crime. Keep your feet moving.
To synthesize this final section, in 3-on-3 overtime, possession is everything. A missed shot is basically a turnover that creates a fast break. After conceding a goal, deploy a low-risk, zero-creativity simple shift to stabilize the momentum.
Right on.
And never let your emotions override the mathematical cost of a penalty, especially realizing that fouling on a breakaway or covering a puck in an empty net are mathematically catastrophic trades dictated by the rule book.
That is exactly how an expert mentally organizes these rules.
Yeah.
You are constantly running the math in your head.
Which brings us to the end of our journey, the outro. We've covered shot metrics, risk maps, lactic acid, rule book typos, geometry, and penalty math. Let's synthesize this entire mental model into one coherent framework.
If we pull all the way back and look at the big picture, game management is not a static set of plays. It is the constant, rigorous, dynamic recalculation of risk based on the ticking clock and the shifting score.
It's always changing.
It is understanding that the ice has geography, that human fatigue dictates physical execution, and that the rule book is full of hidden traps and powerful levers that a smart player can exploit.
So I want to do a final mastery review. If our listener only retains 5 core pillars from this entire deep dive, 5 things to permanently integrate into their mental model of hockey, what are they?
Number 1, leading teams must manage the puck actively, not just passively retreat into a shell.
Mm-hmm.
Protect the dark red high danger slot and avoid the disorganized danger of a neutral zone turnover. Force the opponent to shoot from the perimeter.
Okay, that's 1.
Number 2, shift length and clean line changes are the absolute foundation of team defense. Fatigue causes a cascading failure. First, your brain lags, then your feet stop, then your structure collapses.
Number three,
the math demands that trailing teams pull the goaltender much earlier than traditional coaching fear. Dictate optimally around the 3-minute mark when down by 1 goal.
Pull the goalie early. Got it. Number four,
the icing trap is the ultimate punishment for a tired team. Forcing a defensive zone faceoff with exhausted legs and 0 chance to change is a self-inflicted wound you must avoid, even if it means taking a hit to chip the puck out.
And the final pillar.
Number 5. 3-on-3 overtime is a game of pure possession. A low percentage missed shot is mathematically much worse than taking no shot at all.
Those are phenomenal pillars of understanding. And I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought. We've spent this time unpacking how coaches and players use game management to manipulate risk, time, and space. We've made the invisible visible. Next time you watch a hockey game, whether you're at a local rink or watching the Stanley Cup Finals, do me a favor. Stop watching the puck.
Yes. Force your eyes away from the puck. Watch the players without it. Look at the F3 center holding high near the blue line to safely cover a defenseman's pinch.
Or watch the road team's checking line executing a change on the fly to avoid a mismatch against the home team's stars. Watch a team stubbornly retreat all the way back to their own goalie in overtime just to maintain possession.
When you start seeing those subtle details, you realize you aren't just watching a sport anymore. You aren't just watching simple physics. You're watching a live-action algorithm playing out at 20 miles an hour.
It completely transforms how you experience the game. You finally see the invisible mechanics turning the gears.
Exactly. The murky waters clear up, and you can see the true anatomy of the game. just like an X-ray.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Take this mental model, apply it to your own Beer League gameplay, use it to win arguments with your friends on the couch, and enjoy the game on a whole new level.